wonderful guest, Brandon Lee, the author of this book, Mascara Boy, where we've been talking about his experiences. Book is subtitled Bullied, Assaulted, and Near Death, Surviving Trauma and Addiction. Brandon, welcome back.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for having me back.
Yeah, so we're going to get into the survive stage. If you missed the dive stage, you really should listen to that because, yeah. You know, on the facade, Brandon's growing up in Orange County, living in Anaheim Hills, which is a pretty posh area, hanging around Newport Beach and all that stuff. Young, athletic, handsome guy going to the Catholic school Servite and then Santa Margarita, which are big, big, powerful schools around here, getting kicked out of schools for lighting people on fire.
Lighting shoes, not people.
So you got to back and listen shoes. To that. Oh, yeah.
Shoes, not people.
With people in the shoes.
Yes.
All right. And we're here to talk about survival. I mean, a lot of people that have been through your experience, Brandon, and we talked about trauma is not a competition. We can't say my trauma is worse than yours or yours is worse than mine. Trauma is trauma. It's all legitimate. But a lot of people who would have been through the traumas you experienced being molested by not one pedophile, but three as a young boy, including an next door neighbor, your piano teacher, a soccer coach. This is crazy. Telling your mom and not having the police called. And this is a crime.
Yeah.
Right.
People.
Yeah.
This isn't brushing. These people should be exposed. Turn the lights on, get them in prison. I mean, I shouldn't have to say that, but some people don't get that with child abuse.
Yeah.
Call the police, please. Anyway, you're growing up gay is what I'm trying to say, which is not traumatic. It shouldn't be traumatic, but the fact that you can't talk to your parents about it is traumatic, could be traumatic. You're 19 talking about for the first time, meaning all through high school, you've got this bottled up inside. You've got these experiences with the gay bars down in Laguna Beach, selling sex, which has not got to be fun to talk about. It's an ugly topic, but I'm glad you are because
thank you.
This is real stuff going on in our community.
It's still happening.
Yeah. So let's talk about the big first question I got for Brandon is survival. What is survival and getting your feet on the ground? Talk us through that.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would say that my survival journey to rebuilding a life, right? My survival looked, you know, as soon as, you know, I talked about in that previous episode, how that nurse gave me that $10. And I went to that very, very, very first AA meeting at a church on Melrose and Mansfield in Hollywood. It was on a Thursday night. And I remember walking into that church. Oh my goodness. I was walking in and there was these two gentlemen at the gate and they were handing out raffle tickets. I got to them and they're handing me a raffle ticket. And I was like, nah, man, I'm good. And I did a 180 and I started walking away. And the two guys go, whoa, 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 whoa. Hey, come back here. Like, where are you going? I was like, I'm good. I'm good. No, no, no. Come back here. Come back here. And they convinced me to stay. And so I sat in the very, very, very back of a room that had over 100 people at this AA meeting. That is a big AA meeting. And I didn't even know really where I was and what the heck I was doing. I'm sitting there in the back. I have my hat on super low and I'm listening to this speaker and he's talking about his recovery. And then all of a sudden at the very end of the meeting, they say, we're going to pick two numbers, get out your raffle tickets. We're going to pick two numbers and you're going to come up here and share. So I'm sitting in the back of the meeting and they call this number and the guy sitting next to me, he goes, yo, man, that's your number. And I said, I'm not going out there. You know, mind you, I was just released from the hospital, right? So the guy goes, yo, you called his number. Oh, and I was like, oh my God, I was shaking, walking up. And mind you, like you could hear a pin drop. Everybody's heads are turning like, who is this? And I walked to the podium. I didn't even know what, like, I was supposed to stay, except like, I just said, my name's Brandon and I'm really fucked up. And I just cried. And I said, I don't want to die. Like I was just got out of the hospital on life support. And I don't know what to do, but I know that I'm about to die. And at the end of that meeting, there was like a line of people coming up to me and giving me their numbers. And this group of guys, they were about my age. They came up to me and they said, hey, what are you doing tomorrow morning? And I was like, nothing. And they're like, cool. we'll pick you up at 7 a.m. Are you athletic? And I was like, yeah, I'm athletic. They're like, cool. We play softball. So we'll come pick you up at 7 o'clock in the morning. And so they did. They took me to softball and I remember having a good time and they were laughing and da da da. And then I found out they were all sober. And then they're like, hey, what are you doing tomorrow? And I'm like, I don't know. And they're like, cool, man. Well, we're going to go to softball and then we're going to hit a meeting. And I was like, oh, they just said, be here at 7 a.m. And I drove there and I was there at 7 a.m. To play softball. And I didn't realize what they were doing at the time. I do now, but they were showing me that you could live a life happy and you could smile and enjoy life. And that was just enough to keep me going to meetings, right? Just to kind of keep me going and connected to other people who were in recovery. And I remember like getting those 60 days and I would look at somebody getting like 2 years and thought the world of them. I'm like, my God, 2 years sober. How'd you do that? Because at the very, very end, you know, I was a sex addict. That goes hand in hand with being a meth addict. You know, you are a sex addict. If you're a meth addict, I don't know many people who are just did meth and sex was not connected. But I used to go to those brothels in Hollywood. And there was this one time at the very end where, you know, you're just sitting there in the parking lot. And I was just in tears crying. I was like, I don't want to do this. And I remember saying, I just want a little house with a white picket fence. And I just want to go to a grocery store in the morning. I want to go grocery shopping in the morning. Like I remember that conversation with myself holding a meth pipe in my hand in this brothel and just like a zombie, right? I just walked right into the brothel, you know? And so like when I saw somebody with 2 years, I'm like, oh my God, how'd you make it 2 years without doing that stuff? And so I was able to kind of string that stuff along. So that was really the beginning of the survival stage, I would say, the survival stage of trying to heal.
Wow. And what strikes me is that there's a group of people that kind of in a positive, healthy way identified you as somebody that they could bring into the group and just have a
good time with. Yeah. I was them. Yeah.
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 Well, it's connection. Connection is huge with people with addiction.
You know, yeah. The opposite of addiction is connection, right? Yeah, yeah. So,
yeah. I've heard so many great success stories that have started with AA. Mm-hmm. What parts of the program did you find easy to plug into and what parts did you find not so easy to plug into out of the AA program?
Listen, for 10 years, I went to 5 meetings a week. Yeah. That's a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
You do what you need to do.
But I mean, I know every quote, I know every saying, I know every platitude that's framed in every room of AA. So, I mean, I did it for 5 years. I mean, 10 years of 5 meetings a week, and I'm no longer a member of AA, even though I will always be extremely grateful for the foundation that it gave me at the very beginning, because at the very beginning, it saved me. It was enough to keep me from using. It never healed me, but it was enough. They gave me enough tools to prevent me from taking a drink and a drug. And so, and that gave me space to try to heal, right? You know, so at the very beginning, it was, you know what, I have to tell people the reason why I think unhealed that I made it 12 years of continuous recovery without a relapse was because I was very open and honest in my four step. Like I told them everything. I told them all about the child sex abuse. I did everything. So I think that's the reason why I never experienced a relapse until year 12. Because I was very, very thorough in that four step of doing that internal inventory. It worked until it didn't work anymore for me.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Worked until it didn't. And it didn't until I had my relapse in 2020. But I didn't, some people are like, I didn't find it hard. I went to meetings. I met with my sponsor once a week. I did all the book work. I did it. And I never really looking back, I never saw that as that difficult. I think some of the external parts were very difficult because I was still, you know, hanging out with a lot of the friends who were drinking and using. And I think, you know, not having sex for a year, that was challenging because especially with no therapy, like I couldn't have sex for a year. Well, my God, like drugs and sex were tied so close together and I was a sex addict, but I did it. You know, I did it. I didn't have sex for that first year. I had no relationships for that first year. The hardest parts was like going on a job interview, you know, and being a news anchor and, you know, being on a morning show where they would have like summer cocktail segments, you know, and then people would be like, oh, you know, why can't Brandon have one, you know, like, or going on a job interview and they're having a drink at night and just being like, how do I get out of this? You know, socially it was hard, you know, around those circumstances. But the program itself, it wasn't hard. I mean, it did. It gave me a foundation to not use, But again, I will preach this to the end of time. Just going to AA meetings will not heal you from your trauma. Mm-hmm. Talk therapy alone will not heal you from your trauma.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Absolutely. Well, yeah, great points. I can't wait to revisit that.
Yeah.
That question. Let me ask you something. You're sober the first time in 2010. Do I have that right?
Mm-hmm. Correct. Yeah.
And at what point did you realize that a gay lifestyle could be happy and healthy without the brothels and the boom, boom, room, back alley stuff? At what point did you say, hey, being gay has an unhealthy component, which I've seen in these places, but there's also like a normal life possibility? When did that awakening, or did you know that all along?
No, I didn't. I probably had that awakening a few years ago.
Okay.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, if I'm being honest with you, you know, yeah. You know, I look at the gay, you know, I look at a lot of the behaviors, right, that I used to partake in the gay world. And I think that, you know, there's just so much unhealed trauma. You know, I look at guys in their 40s and 50s and they're still doing the behaviors that I was doing in the 20s. Guys I used to party with in my 20s are in their 40s, 50s and 60s now, and they're still going to circuit parties and doing drugs in their 60s, right? And they're still sex addicts and having group sex in their 60s, right? But, you know, you look at that and that's just because of unhealed trauma from their childhood. And unfortunately, they likely will never rewire their brains. Like, that's just going to be part of their life, even though I know some of them are miserable in it and that's not what they want. But I don't think many of them will do the work necessary in order to rewire your brain to make a healthy relationship work. Because unless you rewire your brain after the trauma, especially that I experienced, you'll never have a healthy relationship. Mm-hmm. Even if you're in a relationship, it's going to be unhealthy. There's no way you're going to choose a partner that is super healthy and supportive with all that trauma. No, you're going to feel comfortable choosing the bad guy. You know, you're going to feel, you know, that's what you're going to be attracted to because that's familiarity and that's comfortability. Right. You know, it's comfortable. So I just realized that a few years ago. And I think what I'm seeing now is that what I'm so grateful to see is that I do see a lot of healthy gay relationships. And I do see that because generationally, it's a lot easier to be gay young now, so that they're having boyfriends in like college, they're having boyfriends in high school. So, you know, for us, and I try to really explain this to people, you know, gay people have always gotten a bad rap because from straight people, oh, they're perverts. They're having sex all the time. They're sex crazed. They're all this. They're having sex in the parks. You know, before those dating apps came around, there would be a lot of cruising at local parks and bathrooms and all that mm-hmm. stuff by gay people. I'm like, okay, first of all, it's because of you, straight people. It's because of straight society that that's happening. Because if you think about it, gay kids like myself in the 80s and 90s, there was no structure to look at. Marriage was not a possibility. Gay marriage was just found legal in 2015.
Yeah.
Like the right to marry is just there. You know, there are still states that say gay people cannot adopt a child. Mm-hmm. So that we never had a structure, a family structure to aspire to. Like like you're a straight man. When you were in high school, you saw your parents getting married. You saw them raising kids. You know, you had those things to look forward to. As gay people, that was never an option. So what the hell did you expect us to do?
Yeah.
Yeah.
You never gave us a safe space and never gave us a dream that we could have marriage, that we could have a family. I never thought that was a possibility. So what am I left to do? I'm left to be secretive. I'm left to go have sex at the park. I'm left to go have sex parties. That's the option that was given to me.
Yeah.
So I look at the straight world, which I write about in my book, and I'm saying, you know, society caused a lot of this behavior that we're seeing in men in their 40s, 50s, 60s, and 70s. Society created that.
Makes sense.
Because society gave us that trauma.
I agree 100%.
Mm, I do too.
As a straight guy, I say absolutely all true. Mm-hmm. And that's why I think it's time that whether you're gay or straight or whatever, we let people as adults do whatever they want to do. Mm-hmm. As long as they're not hurting anybody else.
Hurting other people. Themselves. No.
Yeah, and that's not the case. And this idea that being gay is a pervert. I totally reject that.
Yeah.
But that was the society's climate.
Yes.
In high school. I got 20 years on you and it was probably even amped up a little bit more before that.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I can tell you the people I know as today as an adult that I've kept in touch with and are friends, they they somehow maneuvered and had a pretty normal deal all the way through. In other words, the ones I know didn't get into drugs or the, you know, the prostitution aspects of it at all. They've been pretty conventional and normal. And I think that story is more and more prevalent today, fortunately.
Yeah. It's more accepting.
Yeah. I mean, we, you know, as high schoolers, I have one friend of mine in particular who I recently talked to. I mean, he was a very straight acting guy, but when we found out I was gay, it was like, well, we don't really understand it, but okay, whatever, you know, let's go hang out, you know.
You're still you.
So things are getting better. And that's old history. Today, young people are much smarter than we were.
Yeah. But you and I both know, and especially as a doctor with all the wealth of knowledge that you have, is that when you raise a child, you have to give them structure in order for them to thrive and succeed. They have to be around structure. We didn't have any.
Yeah.
Gay people didn't have any structure. Yeah. So of course we're going to act like wild animals. Like, what else do you expect? It's like taking a pit bull or taking a dog and never training it, or, you know, never doing anything. Of course they're going to be wild.
Yeah.
Right. Of course they're going to go do those things. But that's again, why I have hope for the future, is that I am seeing a lot more, I guess, stability would be the word that I would use, a lot more stability and with this younger gay generation. And that I talked to a lot of them, and a lot of them want families. They want kids. Like, those conversations were never around when I was growing up, ever. But all these gay guys are just like, yeah, you know, like you look at their profiles on dating apps and they're like, you know, life goals. I want several children. You know, I want a husband. And these are the things that I want. Like, that to me tells me society is coming around. But let's not get lost on it. Let's not be lost on this for one second.
Yeah.
Because they're trying to take gay marriage away right now. There are sects of this society who are trying, after we, you know, what we've seen happen with abortion, you know, and Roe v. Wade recently, they're trying to maybe go back to the Supreme Court to overturn gay marriage that was, you know, it took the Supreme Court in 2015 to do those things. Yeah. And so that is not helpful. And that in of itself, and seeing that on the news and hearing people and those beliefs come at you, it's traumatic for a lot of folks. And what it's doing actually is re-traumatizing a whole class of people who thought finally were being looked at as somewhat equals in this country, that I can have a husband legally, that I can have a child. Right. Mm-hmm. And then now to be re-traumatized by the threat of that being taken away, like, that people don't understand. It's so destructive. And, you know, it just goes, I don't know, we can go on a whole show about that, but it's just like, why do you care?
Yeah. I have three friends of mine, one who I went to college with, another who I was actually in the psych unit with, and another one who is a dear friend of our family. And each couple have beautiful children, and they're happy, and they're thriving, and they're phenomenal parents. My gosh, I think, yeah. So without mentioning names, there's two daughters, and then Renee and his partner adopted a son. The son, I think, is like 19 years old. The two girls are still fairly young. But the son is, I mean, they are great, great parents. And for the fact that the Supreme Court would want to retract that, that's devastating.
Yeah, I think it's more some fringe groups that still want to reverse history. Yeah. The whole dynamic has kind of grown up. One thing I am always talking about whenever I have the chance is that a lot of churches are waking up. You go to gaychurch.org.
Very much so.
And you put in your address and all the gay affirming churches in your neighborhood pop up.
Nice. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of places that are have woken up. Woke is probably not the right word to use considering the baggage you can come from.
Yes, exactly.
But honestly, I don't know how else to put it. Waking up. The churches are waking up. And more and more people are saying, hey, this is a completely normal lifestyle. Let's do what Jesus said and let everybody in and period. and just show unconditional love. And a lot of people are kind of catching that message.
That's good. I mean, the church is also waking up towards domestic violence too, whereas before you made your bed, now you need to sleep in it, right? And now we're starting to talk about these things. I actually, two days after I was discharged from the psych unit, my friend who's a pastor, who actually co-wrote the book with my dad, Stop Domestic Violence, An Action Plan for Saving Lives, took his own life. He was a pastor at a church, and he did amazing advocacy for victims of domestic violence. But the church back then, 28 years ago, they weren't open to having these conversations.
Right.
And then in 2004, he ended up, taking his own life.
Yeah.
So we are waking up. We have come a long, long way. Considering.
Yeah, we have. So Brandon, I want to ask you, what other things kind of helped you as you got your feedback on there? Were any particular books or people or
philosophy? Yeah, there was. And I will say this too. I was about maybe 8 years into recovery, and this was really the beginning. I will say this conversation with my therapist was really the beginning of me finally understanding that I had a lot of healing work to do. Because even 7 to 8 years sober, I never considered my behavior that I was doing at age 15, 16, and 17, having sex with well over 1,000 to 2,000 men in Laguna Beach during that time. I never looked at that as rape. And so I actually never even considered one of my child sex predators. I never even considered that to be child sex abuse, because I told her this and I said, he would leave hickeys all over my body because we'd be playing a game called Vampires, and we'd go skinny dipping, but then we'd play a game called Vampires and we'd wrestle on the ground and he would leave hickeys all over my body. And my therapist goes, so you don't see that as a violation. And I said, no, I don't. And she goes, okay. You're a news reporter and a journalist. She goes, I need you to imagine this. You're sitting in an editorial meeting and, you're handing out assignments and they're looking at, we look at the police reports daily to see what's bad is happening in the world. And so we look at a police report and she goes, now read this back to me. A next door neighbor is skinny dipping with a 7-8-year-old boy and they're playing a game called Vampires and he's leaving hickeys all over his body. What's your response? Yeah, it's child sex abuse. And so then we got to age 15 and 16 and I told her, I said, no, that is not sex abuse. Me having sex with those men, like I drove there. I sat on that little alleyway on the little embankment waiting for guys to pick me up and put me in their cars, or I'd go down the steps to the beach and have sex with these men. Like I put myself in that position. I enjoyed it. And I told her, I said, I enjoyed it. It wasn't a violation. And she looks at me and she goes, okay, the next session, I need you to do me this favor. I need you to bring in two pictures of yourself around that age, 15 or 16 years old. Can you do that for me? And I said, sure. So I ended up finding pictures of myself around 15, 16. And she put those pictures in front of me and she goes, look at that boy. Does he look like he should be having sex with men in their 40s and 50s? And it was at that moment, that was really one of my big aha moments. And I broke down crying. Because when I was 15 and 16, I always saw myself older. But now that I'm older and I see that boy at 15 and 16, I'm like, oh my God, like how could a guy my age at age 42, how could I ever have sex with a boy that looks like that? And that was just, that I would say was probably one of the most pivotal conversations I had in my early stages of therapy that really began the healing process, because she's the one that told me I had to tell my parents. She goes, it is, you need to release this burden that you've been carrying, as victims of sex assault do. We carry the burden of shame. Okay. She goes, you need to release that and put that on your parents. You need to share this with your parents and let your parents deal with this. They have a right to know. They need to know, but you need to release that and give it to them. And so that was really, I would say, really one of the more pivotal stages. Also, there's an incredible book out there called The Body Keeps the Score. One of the best trauma books ever written, that really goes into the impact about how trauma impacts our bodies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a great book.
Well, and you're talking about the physiology of trauma. And this is such a great living example of how this works, because what happens when you're traumatized, when you're being raped by predators in the criminal act of child abuse, I mean, I'm just using real terms to describe what's really going on. It rewires the brain, the neurology. Mm-hmm. So that's normalized for the child. There's no consult. I want to reiterate, it's a crime. Call the police. These people should be arrested. But what people don't realize is that neurology gets stuck. It's like a car being stuck with the gas pedal all the way down. Mm-hmm. And cars are not designed to be parked in neutral with the gas all the way revved. So this adrenaline and cortisol is being pumped through the system.
Yep.
There's no completion of the trauma cycle. And to stabilize, we're doing what we're talking about. We're talking to people. You've exemplified, you know, the AA thing, the talking to a therapist. Mm-hmm. Those are, in my book, I call it the dynamic duel. We call it grounding. We don't call it meditation because that word can be triggering for religious reasons for some people. I don't think of it that way, but I respect that some people do. So grounding exercises, I really want to talk to you about that, Brandon. And the other one is, we call it sitting in the fire. Talking to your therapist about this stuff can be excruciating pain in and of itself, but it's healing.
Yeah.
Well, I will tell you, the most pivotal healing that I have done in recovery came after that relapse in 2020, because this is why I tell people all the time, meetings alone will not heal you. Talk therapy will not heal you, because if it didn't, I wouldn't have relapsed after 12 years of continuous recovery. The problem is in 2020, trauma hit. As a journalist, right, COVID happened, which was traumatic for everybody, which is why we're seeing so much overdose and so many new addicts out there, and people's substance use disorder has skyrocketed because of the pandemic, right? Mm-hmm. And then the election in Arizona. Trust me, as a journalist, that was not fun. You know, doing that. And I had so many threats against my life and extortion attempts against me. I was hacked. hacked and doxxed by a conspiracy group, and they threatened to release pictures and videos of me if I did not do what they said, and I could not do what they wanted me to do. And so I had to go into hiding, and that's when I started violently shaking every single night. I mean, violently shaking. Wow. To the point where I went online to this company called Barabee, and I got two weighted blankets that weighed 100 pounds to weigh me down at night, because I couldn't stop shaking. Mm-hmm. And then finally I said, F it. And it was the Wednesday before Thanksgiving of 2020. And I went into fight or flight mode. I was triggered. And I got high for 7 hours. 7 hours. The shame, the weight of shame that I felt, indescribable. Because I had written that book, Mascara Boy, 1 year prior. And here I am relapsing for 7 hours on meth. I couldn't tell my bosses at CBS News, because how could I be a news anchor and I just relapsed on meth? They would have found a way to fire me. So I couldn't go to them. I couldn't tell anybody. I had so much shame. I didn't even tell my therapist, my trauma therapist at the time. I didn't even tell her. That's how much shame I had. Mm. In January 2021 is when I attempted to take my life, because I didn't see any hope for me after that relapse, because I was always taught that I had to start over at 24 hours. And I lost all that time. And 24 hours to me, doctor and Tanya, takes me back to Hollywood Presbyterian Hospital in a coma on life support. I could not do that journey all over again. My ego had put so much pride into those damn chips that they give out at AA. I took more pride in collecting those chips and counting my time than I did on the actual healing. Mm. Because time does not equal happiness. Time does not heal. And so I eventually told my therapist in January that I wanted to end my life. And that's immediately when I started shamanism, very similar to EMDR, but more spiritual, is that through deep breath work, I'm able to drop in and reprocess all that childhood trauma. And so I've been able to reprocess the trauma that I experienced living in my house. I've been able to reprocess all the trauma of the sex abuse that I endured. I've been able to do that so that my inner child doesn't necessarily go into fight or flight mode every time trauma hits. The thing that was happening to me, the violent shaking that I was experiencing, was simply my body saying, dude, you've got no more storage capacity. Mm-hmm. 9/11, child sex abuse, all that stuff, right? Mm-hmm. It was like my body couldn't store anymore. And so the shaking was just my body's natural way of letting that energy out. It was just coming to the surface, right? And so had I done the healing work that was necessary up until November 2020, I truly believe I would have been able to handle those death threats and the extortion attempts without numbing out. Mm-hmm. Because I'm a true believer now. And this, and like I said, I'm always grateful to AA, and I think it does wonders for people as far as setting a foundation. However, I do not believe once an addict, always an addict. And me saying that right there separates me from that 12-step belief. Because I truly believe that even if they say addiction's a disease, fine, I'll go along with that. Just because I'm genetically predisposed to getting a disease does not always mean I will get that disease. Something triggers it. Trauma triggers it. And so I truly believe, right? Because some people, they choose gambling, right? Some people choose food. Some people choose to shop. I just happen to choose a substance because of my trauma. It's all doing the same effect on the brain, right? The cortisol levels, the dopamine, right? Experiencing that joy and pleasure, right? But do we tell somebody they cannot eat again? Do we tell somebody they cannot have sex again? Do we tell somebody they cannot have food again? No, we don't. So why then do we tell somebody, you know, you can never do this again? Now, I'm going to be very responsible on how I say this and believe this, because I truly believe that addiction, just like other diseases, there's a spectrum. Just like autism, there's a spectrum. They say in the big book of AA, some are sicker than others. So even Bill W. back in the day knew that there was a spectrum when it came to addiction. All right. So please understand that when I speak that, and your listeners are watching in, and understand there's a spectrum here. Okay. But not everybody is a level 10 and not everybody's a level one, which is why one program cannot be used to cure an entire class of people. It doesn't work that way. So I say this in that I truly come from the belief that if you heal from the trauma, you heal the person as a whole, and that they will not need to numb out or escape in the same way they did before. And that is my core belief.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, after my mom died, I checked myself into a rehab. I was like, because I knew exactly where, I mean, my God, you and I, we've worked in the industry. We know exactly where this can go. And, you know, I've had a lot of friends who have struggled, family members who have struggled. And for 2 months, I was hitting the bottle and I was like, I got to stop this. But guess what it was from? Trauma. Losing my mom. She was my breath. She was my air. She was my life. My God, like, but for 2 months there, I was going down real fast, but I caught it. You know, and there's no shame in admitting that. You know, that's why I'm always saying, you know, pick up the phone and ask for help. You have to use this thing. This could be your biggest lifesaver. And it saved my life, but also the will, because I knew exactly where I was going had I not stopped. But it all came from trauma.
Well, what I'm really curious about, Brandon, is talk more about the breathing exercises, the deep breathing.
Yeah.
I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So I sit there, I lay there on my couch and my shaman's with me, and we do intense breath work. And he gives me different breath techniques as he's sitting there and guiding me. And after about 7 to 8 minutes, very similar to psychedelics, right? And which is why a lot of shamans, you know, you've heard of ayahuasca, you've heard of, you know, mushrooms and going on those journeys, right? Mm-hmm. All that's doing, doctor, is distracting the frontal lobe. The ayahuasca, the shrooms, that's all that's doing is distracting the general person from their frontal lobe in order to get back to the lower amygdala, you know, where those traumatic memories are stored, right? Mm-hmm. I'm able to do it through deep breath work. So after about 7 to 8 minutes, I truly feel this high effect. My body almost tingles and goes numb. And then all of a sudden I begin to see certain traumas on a film strip. And we just begin there. And he goes, what are you seeing? And in one of my recent sessions, I said, I'm crouched in the corner of my room and I'm yelling, stop, 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 stop. And he goes, what's happening? I said, my parents are getting into a physical fight in the hallway right now. Right. And so he goes to me, he goes, okay, this is what I need. And this is while I'm in that state. He goes, this is what I need you to do. I need you to go over to that little boy. Can you walk over to him? So I walk over to little B that's in the corner with my hands like this, yelling, stop, stop, stop. And I hold him and I look at him and I said, you're okay. You're okay now. Will you walk with me? Will you walk with me out of this room and out of this home? And my shaman goes, what is he saying? And I said, he's saying yes. He goes, grab him by the hand, walk him out the door, and walk out of the house. And we did that similarly to when my parents used to make me sleep. And when we traveled on vacations, they would put my sisters in a different hotel room. And I would have to stay in my parents' hotel room. And I remember begging my sisters. I said, Stephanie, Catherine, please, 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 just let me sleep in your room. Let me sleep in your room. Like, I'll sleep on the ground. I don't even, you can have your own beds. Like, I'll sleep on the ground. I'll sleep on the ground. And my sisters are like, no, you can't stay. You can't stay with us. You have to go in the other room. And so one of the things that I had to reprocess was, what are you seeing? And I said, I'm just thinking to myself, please stop, please stop, please stop, please stop. And my parents would have sex in the bed next to me. And I would hear it all night long. Mm. And my shaman goes, okay, will you go over to little B? And so I walk over to him and I said, will you take my hand? And he did. And I said, I'm going to take you out of this hotel room. And so I walk him out of the hotel room to let him know that he's safe now. Because all of those individual things on a film strip are traumatic memories. And I have to go back to each and every one of those memories and heal myself, heal my inner child from each one of those memories, not just a one-time thing. I do this every Tuesday for 2 hours. And I've been doing this since January 2021 to reprocess that. And now I'm on a different stage of my healing with my shaman in that I've reprocessed all that trauma, but now I'm working on different things of growth and spirituality and manifestation and those kinds of things that I'm working with my shaman on, which we'll get into the thriving part of the podcast. But those are the healing modalities that have really worked for me. And my shaman asked me this question. Brandon, do you love the life you have today? And I tell Toby, my shaman, Toby, I love this life that I have for me today. He says, good. Because, you know, I quit news. I opened up an art studio, which we'll get into the thriving part of the podcast. And I said, Toby, I love this life that I have today. He says, good. Then you need to give thanks to that relapse you experienced in 2020. Because, Brandon, without that experience, you would not have created this life you have today. He says, Brandon, do you love the life you have today? And I say, Toby, I love this life I have today. He says, good. Then you need to give thanks to your mother who abused you at times, because without her, Brandon, you would not have created this life you have for you today. He says, Brandon, you must understand this to be true, that those who experience a lot of trauma in the early stages of their life and heal from it oftentimes have the chance to become the world's best healers. He goes, because Brandon, hurt people, but the opposite must be true in that healed people heal people. And he goes, we have to begin looking at trauma as an opportunity for our bodies to heal from it, to grow from it, and then to help others through their pain. And that is how I found my life's purpose. I found my life's purpose after a relapse, after a suicidal ideation. I found my life's purpose after that relapse. I did not find it 12 years sober. I didn't find it collecting a medallion sitting in front of a room of strangers. If I'm happier now, a year and a half or so, a little over a year and a half, coming up on 2 years after that relapse, if I'm happier now than I was at year 10, 11, or 12, what does that tell you? Yeah. Time doesn't heal. It is the work and the modalities that we do in a set of time that will bring us that joy, that will bring us that freedom from that trauma.
Yeah. Wow.
I want to go on a retreat.
I just learned so much from you just now.
Yeah, for
yeah. sure. So, Brandon, anything else you want to say about the whole big picture of survival and just getting your feet back on the ground?
Right. The best way I can describe that is if I could go back to the beginning, which I can't, And I understand that. But if I could go all the way back to the beginning, for when I came out of that hospital and I went to that very first AA meeting, I tell people this. Listen, if you are struggling, right? You're struggling with substance use disorder, whatever it is, you face trauma, whatever. AA, fine. Go to your 12-step program. Do those things. But if I could go back in time, I would have gone to treatment at the very beginning. Why? Because it would have given me access to different modalities that I could have done that healing work so much quicker. I'm sad that it took me until a relapse in 2020 and a near-death attempt, right? Taking my own life. I'm sad that it took me all the way to that point to realize that I need to do the real healing trauma work in order to set myself free, in order to find that true joy, in order to find and experience that true joy. So I tell people all the time, do it all at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. Invest in that time, the 30, 60, 90 days, 6 months of that true healing. Do EMDR, do neurofeedback, do brain mapping, do trauma therapy, right? Use all of those modalities at the very beginning. Mm-hmm. There's no reason for you to white knuckle, because I tell people this all the time. Sobriety is not just not picking up a drink or a drug for a day. That is not sober.
Yeah.
That is not living. Sometimes you will go to a 12-step meeting, okay? And you will see somebody in that room collecting a 30-year or 35-year medallion. Sometimes those are the meanest, saltiest, crustiest people in the room who tell the newcomer to sit down and shut up. Why? Because they've never healed. Mm-hmm. And I ask that person, how many wives do you have since you've been sober those 30, 35 years? Do you show up for your kids? And how many times have you 13th stepped, meaning having sex with somebody under a year of recovery, right? Yeah. Because that's sobriety to me. Sobriety is showing up for people in their lives. Sobriety is showing up for your children, being a good dad, being a good husband, and those things. But you can only do those things if you heal from your trauma.
Yeah.
Eloquently spoken. And articulately. Shared. Yeah.
Another reason to get this book, Mascara Boy. And as long as we're talking about books, you had Tanya's book.
Yes.
Finding Peace Amongst the Chaos. I mean, I thought I'll never forget the day that Jesse Badafuco, whose name I can say.
Yeah, now, you finally got it.
Said that this book saved her, you know, and this book, Mascara Boy, may save you if you resonate. That's what I love about this podcast is that, you know, there's lots of different angles and everybody contributes some of the conversation.
Absolutely.
Hopefully I have my book. It comes out in 2023, but the printer's finished 400 pages. It's more kind of a textbook, but there's a lot of great science to work through each chapter. What strikes me, Brandon, is that as you're talking, I'm thinking, oh yeah, that's right on the money. Yep. I mean, I researched for 15 years on this stuff and you figured it out by yourself.
So that's we went through it.
Lived experience, right? Lived experience.
Absolutely.
As long as we're landed at the same place and helping people kind of process.
It's what it's all about.
That's all it is.
We're all on a team of, just trying to get the conversation amplified. So.
Yeah, and I love how you said healed people heal people. Because right. I always say hurt people.
But the opposite always is true.
Absolutely. I love that. I'm going to start using that. I'm
going to
steal that from you.
Yeah. Good. Steal it. Steal away.
I will.
Well, thank you, Brandon, so much for spending so much time and your great insights. I can't wait to get into the Thrive episode next here on Post-Traumatic Thriving, where we dive, survive, or thrive.
The choice is yours.
Thanks, Brandon.
Thank you, Brandon.
Thanks for supporting our podcast. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe, and follow us on your favorite social media. For books, merchandise, or to donate, visit coreiq.com. Post-Traumatic Thriving is produced by CoreIQ, a nonprofit with a mission to teach the life skills we all need but are not taught in school. CoreIQ and the Post-Traumatic Thriving podcast are for informational purposes only and do not provide medical or mental health advice. Always consult with your licensed medical and mental health care providers.